Well, they blew up a chicken man in Philly last night. Now they blew up his house too. Down on the boardwalk, they're getting ready for a fight. Gonna see what them racket boys can do. Now there's trouble busting in from out of state, and the DA can't get no relief. Gonna be a rumble out on the promenade and the gang.
Hello, and welcome to the Daily Music Break, which is at www.dailymusicbreak.com. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with Ryan White, a journalist and author who just released a book entitled Springsteen, album by album, in honor of the boss's 65th birthday. Thank you very much for joining us today, Ryan.
No, thanks for having me, Carl. I really appreciate it.
It's our pleasure. I really do appreciate it. Ryan, before we get to Springsteen and the book, could you give us a little bit about your background, who you've written for, and what you've been doing?
Yeah. I spent 16 years at the Oregonian newspaper out here in Portland, Oregon. I moved out here from Ann Arbor, Michigan in 1997, not long after I graduated from college. And I covered sports for a while, for about 10 and a half years. And then I covered music for about 5.5 years. And these days, you know, you stay at one newspaper for 16 years, there's a good chance eventually they're going to ask you to leave. And they asked a bunch of us to leave last summer, and it just so happened that I had recently signed the contract to do this book. So I walked out of the door of the Oregonian at the end of August 2013, and took a couple of days at the beach with my family and some friends. We go every year for Labor Day, and then when we got back to town on Tuesday, I started in for about 5 months of 15-hour days of working on this book, and really, really proud of it. The folks who put it together, Palazzo Editions, which is over in England, and then it's out in the U.S. on Sterling and available any place you can get books. Wherever you buy your books, they should have it at this point. They mm-hmm. they did a fantastic job of loading this thing up with photos and timeline, and it's really fun to have my words around such a cool package.
It sounds fabulous. So people can get it at the Amazons of the world. And is there a website for the book or for the company that's publishing it?
Yeah, I mean, my website's got kind of a clearinghouse for it at this point. It's mm-hmm. hard to find anything that isn't book related on my site, which is ryanwwhite.com. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of Ryan Whites out there, so we threw the middle initial in there. And that'll direct you to, if you do Amazon, it's on Amazon. If you're a Barnes & Noble person, it's Barnes & Noble. If like me, you're lucky enough to have a really cool independent bookshop like Powell's, like we have here in Portland in town, you can get it there. If you speak German or French or Italian or Spanish or Swedish, it's been translated into those languages and are available over there.
Great. Well, we wish you the best of luck with it. And let's talk a little bit about the book and about Springsteen. Now the book, obviously from the name Album by Album, looks at Springsteen's albums in general, and I guess chronologically.
Yep.
Did your opinion of the albums change? Maybe not from like to dislike or vice versa, or was there a transition in how you felt about the albums as you dove into them, or did you feel about the same afterwards, just knew a lot more about each album?
You know, probably a couple of albums changed in different ways. I'd always loved Darkness on the Edge of Town. It had probably always been my favorite Springsteen record anyways, but I really kind of appreciated that on a kind of a new and different level. And I think, you know, having lost the job that I'd had for 16 years, you know, and then you start working on Darkness on the Edge of Town, suddenly you feel like one of the characters in Darkness on the Edge of Town.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's some kind of cracks and crevices in that album that I had never quite experienced or never quite picked up on. I mean, there's the line in Candy's room where you know, there's this guy and he's just like, he's so romantic and he just wants to make her his and take her away from this place. And she, you know, she goes, you know, you've got a lot to learn. And it was like listening to that for the, you know, the 24th, 25th time that I realized that was almost like a pat on the head. She's like, oh, you've got a lot to learn about the world. Yeah. And so I really, you know, I found an even deeper kind of, you know, appreciation for Darkness on the Edge of Town. Interestingly, I kind of like Born in the USA less now than I did before. I mean, and it's always been, you know, I mean, it's an interesting record because it was maybe the first time that, you know, it really was a collection of songs. He worked like mad to try and hold it together. But even when he did his book Songs, he wrote that, you know, there was the title track and then a bunch of songs that he felt generally ambivalent about. And it's a great record with, you know, the windows down in the on a hot summer day and blasting off the stereo. And I, you know, and I still play all of those songs and like a lot of the songs individually. But as an album, you know, especially when you start looking at some of the other full album works, which is what he's done as well as anybody in the rock era is, you know, in the album era was make albums. You know, it doesn't quite hold together there.
Very interesting. Well, what was your approach? Did you just listen? You know, you've heard, obviously, when you got this assignment to sign this contract, you knew all the Springsteen albums.
Yeah.
What did you do differently now that you knew you had to write something substantial about each of these albums? What was your approach?
A lot of research. I was lucky. Peter Ames Carlin, who wrote a fantastic bio called Bruce that came out in 2012, and it was the first time in 25 years that Bruce had cooperated with anybody doing a book. Peter opened up his reporting archives to me, and you know there was a lot of little stuff about albums that kind of helped me dig into those, be it, you know, something Bruce had said or something Steve Van Zandt said, any of the guys in the E Street Band, the people who worked on it, worked on those records, we're all in there. And so I pulled a lot from that, a lot of going back to, you know, to stuff that was written at the time. I was really interested in, because when I got into Springsteen in my 20s, you know, kind of, I got into him a little before The Rising, and then, you know, that was the first tour where I was really paying a lot of attention. I think I've seen him about 10 times since. He was already this very weighty cultural figure. And, you know, I kind of missed the buildup to that. And obviously, you know, I had gone back and filled in some blanks and I'd read books and stuff like that. But I hadn't gotten down to the level of, you know, what the day-to-day reviews were saying, what, you know, what the big profiles, the big interviews of the time. I hadn't necessarily read a lot of that. So there was a lot of going back and trying to connect the dots as to how he went from this kind of spindly Jersey shore rat with a bad beard to this kind of granite jawed figure that we see today that we turn to and, you know, well, this has happened. What will Bruce Springsteen say about this? You know, the guy that you see out on the campaign trail, the guy that, you know, the guy that has become in some ways, you know, an avatar for Americanness. And so it was in pulling out a lot of those details, a lot of his influences, you know, how Hank Williams kind of started to come into his music, the discovery of Woody Guthrie, the old soul and, you know, soul and R&B and doo-wop that would come in through the transistor radio that his mother kept in the kitchen, and how you ended up with, you know, the real, you know, the authority of the musical history of this country informing, you know, his voice and his vision. And all of that was interesting and new to me. And I, you know, I tried to connect those dots as well as I could throughout the book.
Beautiful. And that leads nicely, I think, to the next question. And it's always whenever I think of people who have risen to the top in music or in other walks of life, I always wonder what separated them from the others. There were, I'm sure, a lot of people with a lot of talent on the Jersey Shore running around in those days. And Springsteen broke through and became, as you say, the guy who is, you know, a megastar today. What is there anything that you can identify that allowed him or enabled him to break through from being that kid on the shore to being who he is today and rise above those other acts with which he was competing in those days?
in some ways, it was just sheer willpower. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of what you still see on stage today, the idea that, you know, there might be one person out there, you know, these days, it's there might be one person out there that hasn't seen me before, but has heard kind of this mythical story, and he's going to show them that there's something to it.
It's true.
It's interesting because what you saw, you know, in those days on the shore was a lot of talented people, you know, they connected with what, you know, not only with what he was doing, but how he was doing it. And they saw the star in him before there was a star to see. They, you know, they said, you know, if I'm going to make it, I got to hitch, you know, I got to hitch my car to this train, because this is the locomotive that is going to bust through if anybody will. He just, you know, you put him on stage and he became a rock star long before he was a rock star. There's just that aura about him. There's, you know, this didn't make it into the book because it didn't make any sense. And it almost made it into an essay that I wrote. And I cut it out because I cut it out because it just didn't quite work there either. But there's a great Drive-By Truckers lyric, a song Mike Cooley wrote where it says, "Saving everybody takes a man on a mission with a swagger that'll set the world at ease."
Right.
And I've always kind of thought of Springsteen when I hear that lyric. I mean, there's this, you know, there's this swagger about him. And at the same time, it you know, it just I've told this story a few times. I took a friend of mine to see his first Springsteen show, and it was up in Seattle. And we ended up we got lucky with the lottery and ended up right in front of Bruce for the entire night. And afterwards, the house lights come up and people are starting to mill about and file out. And I looked at my friend. I said, "So what do you think?" And he goes, "I just want to call my mom and tell her that I love her." That was his reaction at the end of the night. And so I think from a very early age, people reacted to him that way, and people went out of their way to help him. I mean, Mike Appel originally, you know, his first manager, obviously they, you know, they fell out and had legal wranglings later and patched it up years down the road. But, you know, Appel moved mountains for him because he believed in him, you know, got him on the cover of Time and Newsweek on the same week.
Right. I remember that.
When they needed that hit, when they needed Born to Run to be the album that it was. I mean, you know, you see what, you know, what John Landau saw in him that night in Boston to go home and write that famous piece about, you know, I have seen rock and roll future. And, you know, it was interesting to me working on the book, you know, reading that Landau piece all the way through, you can hear echoes of it or almost a response to it in Thunder Road, because, you know, the beginning of that Landau piece is it's the middle of the night and he's getting old and he can't find the fire in rock and roll that he used to have. And, you know, a few months later, there's Bruce writing, you know, "So you're saying, you know, saying we ain't that young anymore. Have a little faith. There's magic in the night."
Right.
So, you know, people have, he's gotten the right people on his side. And then he's not let them down. You know, he's put in the work. He's put in the work to do it.
And did it also work that if people could see this in him, that he was able to get the best people in his band early on, like, you know, Clarence and, you know, Van Zandt and so on and so forth? Were they, you know, did he quickly get the people who he needed? Was that an issue as well?
Yeah, I think he did. I mean, you look at a guy like Van Zandt and they talk about, you know, their history together. There were only, you know, if as much as there were more and more bands building, you know, there was still a pretty tight community. And if you loved music and you loved rock and roll and if you loved it obsessively, you were going to connect with each other. And certainly Steve Van Zandt was one of those guys, you know, a bass player like Gary Talent, really, you know, really fantastic musician. You know, all of those guys. And, you know, and some of them were goofballs, especially in the early days. You get the idea that Danny Federici was probably a pretty wild guy and a pain in the butt. But he had this intuitive way of playing that fit perfectly with what Bruce was doing. I mean, Clarence, you know, could you have gone out and found a better saxophone player? Technically, probably yes. You could never have had a better Clarence Clemons.
Right.
Though, I mean, Clarence, this sounds stupid to say, but I think you'll understand what I mean. Like, Clarence was the absolute greatest Clarence that will ever have walked this earth. I mean, he was the perfect onstage foil for Bruce, you know, he brought something to the mix that nobody else could have brought. And yeah, he, you know, that story of I write in the book a little bit about the kind of the genesis story of Clarence joining the band, the idea that there's that howling nor'easter and Clarence opens the door to the student prince and the door blows off the hinges and goes down the street. And it's like, did it blow off the hinges? Did it really not blow off the hinges? I don't think I want to know. I think I just want to think that it did. And I think, you know, the essential truth of the matter is, given the power of what they did over the decades, the doors absolutely blew off the place.
Mm-hmm. Was the power of Springsteen early on, was it manifest first in the music and the rock and roll, or in the lyrics, which of course are as much a part of Springsteen and the Springsteen legacy as the rock and roll music itself? Did one come first, or did they come together?
Yeah, I mean, he obviously, I mean, if you're talking like pre-first album, I mean, they were playing some of those first bands, you know, stuff like, why am I absolutely blanking on the name of the early bands? Go back, we'll find them. But I mean, they were playing like prog rock and Cream and you know, all of these, you know, they're these lengthy 10, 11, 12, 15 minute songs that were really, you know, howling musically. And he was starting to feel his way into, you know, into lyrics. There was, you know, there was a little bit of political stuff that was really more just because that was the stuff that was in the air at the time, you know, anti-Vietnam war protests, civil rights movement, all of that. It was really, you know, heading into Greetings when he'd made himself into a bit of a solo acoustic act that he was trying to develop his writing voice.
Right.
And you saw it in the, you know, the really kind of epic tales that defined the second album. And I think when he really found his voice was that third record, when he started to pare it down. It's less wordy. Everything is more concise, has more of a purpose to it. And, you know, he worked those lyrics and worked those lyrics and worked those lyrics. And that's what he would do for the next bunch of albums. I mean, Darkness is as tight a piece of writing is from front to back as you'll find. And then, you know, The River is huge in scope, but all of those songs, you know, do a lot of heavy lifting lyrically. And that is, you know, that as much as anything is what's, you know, what grabs people. That early wordiness obviously got him helped get him the Dylan, the next new Dylan thing that he had to fight back against. But he's a guy who's always been pretty good at fighting back against things. And it in some ways helped him. But yeah, I think those two things go hand in hand, and they've never been far apart once he started to find his own voice.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to drill down on particular albums during this interview, with one exception. The album that's always really stood out to me, and I'm a big Springsteen fan, but I'm not a, you know, he's one of my favorites, and I have a lot of favorites. I guess that's the way to put it. But the album that's really resonates a lot with me is Nebraska.
Yeah.
What is your feeling about that album?
I love Nebraska. And, you know, Nebraska is one of those records that has become, you know, like I'm a big fan of what we're calling Americana these days. And it has really become a cornerstone kind of in the foundation of modern Americana. And, you know, it's such a – what's great about it is the record as we hear it was not, you know, how we were ever supposed to hear it. It was it has – you know, no self-consciousness, because it was just a collection of demos. And they ended up not being able to improve on them when they took them into the studio with the E Street Band. And so basically what you heard on the cassette, which had then been mixed on a, you know, at home on a boombox that had, you know, for a while been shorted out after it got splashed by a wave coming over a boat when they were out on the river, kind of thing. Like there's nothing about that album that makes any sense. And yet it's just this, you know, perfect, dark, you know, dark piece of work. And the exact, and you know, coming off of the river, which had made him really, you know, a rock star in terms of like global fame. They'd gone back over to Europe for the first time since Born to Run, had a huge run of shows there. He had the bank account to match kind of the critical success and everything else for the first time in his life. And he does the exact thing that nobody would expect you to do in releasing that record. And it's an amazing piece of work. And it's funny because I was, you know, obviously working on a book like this, whatever album I was working on, you're listening to it all the time, listening to it in the car, listening to it at home, and like the vinyl on upstairs. And so I was listening to Nebraska one day when I picked my then 3-year-old daughter up from daycare, and the title track was on, and she's like, and she says, "Daddy, what's this song about?" And I paused, and I said, "It's about some people who did some bad things to other people." Were those other people okay? No. No, they weren't.
Hopefully she won't know ever or for years and years and years what it really kind of thing is really about.
Yeah, she loves working on the highway, and I really hope she never finds out that it's really about taking a minor girl, you know, an underage girl across state lines. But
Springsteen, I believe that Johnny Cash covered a song on Nebraska. I should have looked this up before the interview, but it might have been Johnny 99.
Yeah, he's done Johnny 99 before.
Yeah, that must have. I bet that probably thrilled Springsteen to have Johnny Cash cover his song.
I'm sure. There's funny. I came across a video on YouTube of Justin Townes Earle and Joe Pug doing. I want to say it was Atlantic City. And Justin Townes Earle is doing the introduction. And he said, you know, he goes, "If you don't like Springsteen, you don't like Hank Williams. And if you don't like Hank Williams, you don't like songs."
Well, that's putting it right out there. Now, Springsteen obviously is a super duper star, and he's had to deal with aging. The book, he's turning 65.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to me always to see how the people who did survive deal with it. The Rolling Stones deal with it a certain way, which is kind of odd, but I guess it's the only way they could. How do you feel that Springsteen has dealt with superstardom, almost post-superstardom? He's like superstar emeritus, it almost seems like. You know, what's your reaction or what's your commentary on what he's done since he was a superstar, since he was on the cover of Newsweek and Time on the same week?
I mean, he's handled it remarkably well. I mean, he seems so, and obviously, you know, he has his rock star tendencies and his rock star bank account, and, you know, enjoys the privileges that come with membership there. But, you can go up and down the street and you start talking about Springsteen with people, and you hear stories of interactions with him that are entirely human and normal and down to earth and great. He seems to have almost forced a certain amount of normality in his life, that like, if I just go out and do things, I will be able to go out and do things and, you know, appreciate that somebody's probably going to want a picture or somebody's going to want an autograph. But, you know, he's been able to maintain a pretty seemingly normal sense of self while continuing to push himself artistically. I mean, I don't think there aren't a lot of people his age who go out and play shows anymore who are going to have the confidence or even the interest in playing, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 songs off the new album and trust that the audience is going to stay with them. And sometimes they do, and sometimes you don't. I mean, you see people get up and go to the bathroom sometimes and some of the new stuff. But, you know, he's really pushing himself still, I think, to try and, you know, to make a statement, to make it worth his time and everybody else's time to make a new record. And as he said before, the phrase he uses, you know, continue the conversation that he's been having with his fans. And I've always thought that that's an interesting phrase because, you know, he doesn't feel like he's talking at people. Like it's going both ways there. And I think that's helped him a lot. And he's also, there's no amount of, I've always thought that, you know, for all of us, a little bit of self-awareness goes a long ways. Sure. And he's always seemed, you know, very, very aware of, you know, of various things. There's the, you know, the famous lyric is, you know, from Better Days, it's a sad, funny ending when you find yourself pretending a rich man in a poor man's shirt. He's gone out of his way sometimes to kind of puncture his own, to pop his own bubble a little bit, because how else are you going to get through the world with every, you know, the way people feel about him, the, you know, the reverence with which they hold him, he is still just a guy, and who I think wants to be seen as just a guy. And so sometimes you gotta pop your own myth a little bit. And he's been pretty good with that.
It's kind of funny because the next question I have here on my list is exactly that, which is, has he had any problem dealing with simultaneously being a super rich guy and also being a blue collar guy, or is that not an issue to him? So you actually, answered the question before I asked it, I guess.
Yeah, there's a story in the book. There's a, you know, Steve Van Zandt was, there's the song called Ain't Got You, which was the first track on Tunnel of Love, and Tunnel of Love was the first album after Born in the USA, which, you know, obviously made him, you know, bigger than a rock star. He was everywhere with Born in the USA. And the first track is Ain't Got You, which is really largely a song about material wealth. It's, you know, I got the fortunes of heaven and diamonds and gold and all the bonds, baby, that the bank can hold. And Van Zandt hated that song. And Van Zandt said, you can't put that out. You're the greatest representative of the working class since Woody Guthrie. What are you doing with this? And Bruce said, well, it's honest. And Van Zandt said, I can make you an argument that honest is the last thing art should be. And you can, you know, reading this interview that Peter Carlin did with him, you can almost hear Van Zandt's shoulders slouch as he sighs and says, you know, that's another argument that I lost. And Bruce put it out. And, you know, later that year in that tour cycle, Esquire ran out a big piece called Saint Bruce that in a lot of ways, you know, kind of, you know, took to knocking Bruce down off the mountain a little bit. But I think he'd done a fair amount of that on his own. And in hindsight, well, you know, I'm sure people were, you know, fans were pretty livid about the Esquire piece. I think in hindsight, Bruce would probably agree with some of it anyways, because it largely wasn't about him, but the perception of him, which, you know, things can get a little overly heady sometimes.
Right. It leads very well to the next question, too. And where do you think Springsteen is going from here?
Wherever he wants, it seems. He has, you know, he seems in a lot of ways to have reached that place in the sun that he wrote about in Born to Run. You know, what you're seeing from him now is, you know, he's putting out music when he feels like putting out music without the pressure that everything has to live up to Born to Run. He's, you know, he works with the E Street Band. He works with other musicians. He does solo stuff. He's in, you know, you've seen him embrace the internet in the last year, like he hasn't and the organization hasn't before. They, you know, they offered the last couple of legs of the last tour, a couple of days after the show, you could download the audio from that for, you know, for $9.99. And there's some fantastic recordings. It's fantastic. Like I almost always run to the show from Pittsburgh on the last tour, which was just fantastic. And you know, you've seen him. He in what was it in January maybe? He was in Florida and took off on a little motorcycle excursion on his own, and then posted a bunch of photos on, you know, a bunch of Instagram photos and stuff up to his website with, you know, hanging out in the bar, and photos with the bartender at this random little place in Florida. And even like in one of the captions asked a guy that he went riding with as he left the bar, he's like, hey, I lost your phone number. Could you give it to so-and-so at the bar so I can get it the next time I'm down there?
Uh-huh.
Kind of stuff. And so he seems to be in this really comfortable place, this place where he's gonna keep making music, and he's gonna keep doing tours, and, you know, keep having his say in you know, in whatever way he feels like, you know, he can be useful, and it's gonna be fun to watch, I think.
So it's almost like he came out the other side of fame and fortune as a healthy guy.
Yeah.
Probably doesn't happen that much.
No, and every now and then you'll see photos, and you know, in the front of Rolling Stone or something, of him like out at the beach somewhere in Europe or something, and you just feel like you're not doing a good enough job taking care of yourself if you start doing crunches and push-ups and, you know, carrying a guitar everywhere, I guess. But
that's probably joins the road crew or something.
Yeah.
Looking. Last question, Ryan. Do you feel differently about Springsteen after this? You know, well, to back off a second, sometimes, you know, what I like to say is that the reality and the truth about heroes is very, very, very often much more interesting than the legend is.
Yeah.
You've learned a lot about Springsteen, obviously, since you started researching this book. Do you feel differently about him, or do you feel about the same?
I think about the same. I mean, the knowability of Bruce is something that I think has always been part of the appeal. And obviously there's an element of show business in what he's allowed to present and stuff like that. But, you know, you hear enough, you talk to enough people and you hear enough stories and, you know, there's a guy there that's trying to do his best and, you know, he's done really well at it, obviously, and in a great many ways. But, you know, what I've always loved about, you know, the idea of Bruce, about Bruce's music, about, you know, about Bruce is that he's a guy out there trying to do his best every day. And I think we all hope that we can do that in some way. You know, thinking about him at 65, a couple of weeks ago on his birthday, one of the things I thought about is, because, you know, normally 65 is, hey, congratulations, you're retiring, Social Security, all of this. And he's not retiring, and, you know, he certainly doesn't need Social Security. But what it struck me as is the celebration of it was in his career is kind of a victory for empathy over apathy and for sincerity over irony. The one thing he's never been is ironic, and when he's tried it, it hasn't worked. And that sincerity seems rarer and rarer in public life. And so I think we should hold on to it and celebrate it when we can, and, you know, do our best with it ourselves. And that's what I've always liked about him. And, you know, it was funny. Somebody asked me the other day, I was like, so can you even stand to listen to Springsteen doing this book? I was like, you know what? I put Darkness on the stereo yesterday while I was doing dishes upstairs and stuff. My wife might have a different answer for that, but I am still listening to as much Springsteen as ever.
You should play a joke on her and tell her you just signed a contract to do an album by album of ABBA or something like that.
You know, she would love that. She would love that. I think what would terrify her would be if I told her I was doing like Motley Crue album by album.
It's funny when people talk about Springsteen, their biggest fans who I've spoken to, he's the ultimate rocker. But what they end up talking about is the guy and not the rock and roll. You know, and that's, I guess, a great thing. They talk about who he is, what he stands for, what he represents, as opposed to the fact that the guy is, you know, an all-time rocker.
Yeah.
That's, if I had to opt for one of the two, I would opt for, you know, I would opt for that.
Yeah, and I think the two go hand in hand. You know, I always come back, and I did a lot working on the book to the big lyric at the end of Darkness on the Edge of Town and the title track, which is last on the album, about how, you know, I'll be on that hill because I can't stop. I'll be on that hill with everything that I got. And again, you just hope that, you know, when it's your time to stand up and do something meaningful, that you can give it your best.
Ryan, it's been great. If you could fill us in one more time on where people can read more about the book and perhaps order it, that would be great.
Absolutely. It is, again, the book is Springsteen, Album by Album. It is available everywhere books are sold at this point. I even got a photo from Germany today with somebody who had purchased it in Germany. The clearinghouse for everything, my website is ryanwwhite.com.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you very, very much for your time. It's been really interesting, and I appreciate all the great insights you had. Thank you very, very much, Ryan.
Thank you. I appreciate you doing this. It's been fun.
This has been Carl Weinschenk for the Daily Music Break at www.dailymusicbreak.com. Thanks very much for listening, everybody.
Out here the nights are long, the days are lonely. I think of you and I'm working on a dream. I'm working on